Welcome to IVA Writes Now, Writers Radio. Let's get started for this week's great edition, Success Tips for People in the Literary Fields. Here's your host, Dr. Andy.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this special edition of Dr. Andy's Writers Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Andy, and with me, or this particular interview, is author, filmmaker, and documentarian Lennon Honor, and we're going to be discussing his latest book, Deep in the Consciousness, as well as talk about the media influences that govern our lives and how it affects us when we, as creative beings, try to do something like write a book. So please enjoy. This is the first half of that interview. It's very in-depth. I hope you'll enjoy it and come back for the second part.
Okay, Lennon, why don't you start off by telling everybody about yourself?
Yeah, sure. My name is Lennon Honor, and in the first place, I'm a father and husband, been married to my wonderful wife, Aida, for the last 11 years, and we have five wonderful babies. In addition to being a father, I'm a musician, documentarian, and author. Recently, I released a book, Deep in the Garden of Consciousness, and there's a story in that book called The Coming of Cato. I'm going to be turning that into a motion picture, and also have many music albums that I've recorded that you can find on LennonHonor.com. I also have another website, LennonHonorFilms.com, where I have a lot of my documentary work. Most of my work on LennonHonorFilms.com is dealing with the entertainment industry, media, subliminal messages, media manipulation. On LennonHonor.com, I deal more with personal growth and family and fatherhood and motherhood and male-female relationships, those types of issues there. So I guess you can say I kind of delve into a lot of different topics, a lot of the different areas of focus. I'm here today to talk with you about some of the – we did a radio interview a couple of days ago, but it didn't record, so I guess we're going to be talking about what we spoke about a couple of days ago.
Absolutely, absolutely. And for those of you who are just joining us, welcome. We were talking about the wonderful ways people are judged based upon the media and their way of manipulating how others see you.
Yes.
And the reason we started on that conversation, aside from your documentary work, was because you had revealed the way that you it was the type of stumbling block for the beginning of your second book, before you'd even begin to write the second book, because you didn't feel you were worthy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and that's, just to give people a little background, when I wrote the Deep in Garden of Consciousness, some of the information that's in that book I actually had written 10 years ago. But one of the things that has happened, I guess you can say since that time, has been I've really had to go internally and kind of deal with a lot of the programming that I'd received. And a lot of the programming that I received was, that I couldn't do certain things, or that somehow, I couldn't make particular contributions, or somehow I was unworthy of certain types of information or sharing certain thoughts and ideas with people. The more and more I've dealt with those levels of programming, the more and more I realize that, I am worthy of doing good things, and I can provide examples for people the world over, of a man who is committed to his family, who is a loving father, and who genuinely has concern for the human species, and that I can write a book, and that I can do documentary work, I can do music work. But this book in particular, because the nature of the topics expressed in there, it was very difficult at first for me to get comfortable enough internally to where I can write the book. And this just goes to show you that the media manipulation, we're all impacted by it, and a lot of the media projections of young males, and in particular young black males, are so derogatory that there are many of us who have wonderful things to contribute to the world, but because of the programming, it becomes a roadblock for us. And it takes some time for us to get beyond the roadblocks. And when we're able to get beyond the roadblocks, we can actually contribute something very, very positive. And I consider my work on LennonHonorFilms.com, LennonHonor.com, and in this book, I do feel that it can have a positive impact on people's lives.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so how long actually did it take you to finally, when you did finally get past that roadblock, to put all of this together to get to the second book?
It took me maybe about 2 months. But again, a lot of the stuff was already written and had been written. And a lot of the information in there I had already spoken about on radio shows. It's one thing, though, to talk about it, but it's another thing to put it down on in a book. inside of a book.
So true.
Yes, it just takes on a whole new dimension. So I would say 2 months from the time that I finally decided, and I had had a lot of people ask me, you know, well, can you talk about, you know, spirituality? What are your ideas about and thoughts about spirituality? What do you feel about consciousness, metaphysics? And I had had a lot of people ask me to do work on that particular topic, but I was just so hesitant. You know, I hadn't gotten to a point where I was comfortable enough internally to where I can share my insight without feeling like I was unworthy of the information that I was sharing. But once I got beyond the roadblocks and I decided to you know, put pen to paper, as they say, I would say 2 months. But for me, when 2 months for me is like you know, a year for someone else. Because when I start on a project, I go full force and I put my head down and I basically extinguish myself. It's like I run myself into the ground until I get it done. So those 2 months, it was very intensive, labor intensive. Also in terms of spiritually, I had to really, you know, be focused during that time. And within 2 months, I'd gotten pretty close to a final draft of the book. And finally, you know, I figured out how to kind of get it. I had a friend of mine who actually helped me to figure out how to get it in hard copy form. And I guess it was towards the end of last year, I published the book, and it has been very well received so far.
Okay. Now let's talk a little bit about the publishing. Now, did you have a publisher in mind? Did you shop publishers, or did you choose self-publishing?
Yeah, self-publishing. All of my work I do myself. My wife, she has a cookbook. We publish that ourselves. Documentary work, published it ourselves. I have lecture series and DVD. We do all of our own publishing. And to be quite honest with you, it never even came to my mind to consider going to a publishing company, because that's just not the way that I've, you know, kind of perceive my creations. It's like this is something that I'm creating. I want to be as responsible for it, and it may be that not as many people are able to receive the book because of you know, publicity and so forth. But I do know that the people who receive it, they are the ones who need it. You know, they need it right now, and so they will be drawn to the book. But really, it never occurred to me to even consider doing publishing. I've always been the kind of person that I like to do things myself and, you know, take care of all areas, including, you know, the marketing and publicity and so forth and so on.
Great. Absolutely. Absolutely. But what I think a lot of people don't know, and some of the writers out here in the audience listening in, they do not realize that it's a stigma, kind of like the rest of the media manipulation, which we'll get back to coming up, about what happens if you go to the big six, the worldwide publishers who control the majority of the books. They don't actually market you anyway. Mm. You still have to do the marketing, and a lot of people don't know that.
Yes. And then if you already have a group of following already, you know, the marketing is there. You know, you just have to, you know, make sure you send out. And it's different nowadays because we're dealing with the internet and it's infinite communication. If you have a website and you have a large group of people who come to the website, well, the marketing on that level is already done for you. I mean, you can cross market. You can also, you know, reach into different demographics and so forth. And there's work that's involved with that. But ultimately, you know, I've always been the kind of person that I have to do it myself. And if I don't know how to do it, I'll ask someone else to assist, or I'll figure out how to do it. You know, I'll go in and research on the particular topic. So you're absolutely right when it comes to, you know, getting the word out there and marketing. In many cases, even if you're dealing with a publishing company, you still have to do a certain amount of work. It's not like they do it for you. And then also there's the other issues in terms of editing. You know, they may say that there are certain things that you cannot say inside your own book, and there's things that you should say, or we want you to phrase this way, or change this, or change that. And that when it comes to my own creativity, I can't operate like that. You know, I consider myself to be a very creative being, and I can't have restrictions placed upon my creativity. So that's another thing to consider. You know, for people who are interested in publishing their book, you know, and you can always publish, self-publish, and then later, if you decide, you can look to, you know, getting a publishing company. It's just the route that I've always taken with my own creative work, whether it's music, writing, you know, documentary work, or lectures. I've always taken a hands-on approach.
Absolutely. So that's very true. And I noticed there's a lot of people who don't pay attention to the fact that what happens is, like you were saying, if you have the large following and they're already coming, and of course you've now built your credibility, well, then out of the woodwork, the publishing houses will come to you and offer to publish your material, but not because they actually believe in what you've written, but because they can see those dollar signs from the people that you've already sold to.
That's right. And the same thing applies. I've done I'm a radio show host as well, and I've had the same experience as a radio show host with over the years developing a following. And I've had people who have contacted me to ask, would you be interested in, you know, joining our network? You know, and it's internet-based, but still. And I just, I've never agreed to join any network except when I first started learning how to be, you know, a radio show host. But after that, once I had learned the skill, when I got offers, I was like, no, I want to be able to do and talk about whatever I want to. I want to be able to do shows and I want to and so forth and so on. It's interesting because once you have that following, you're absolutely right. That's, you'll see that you know, you will begin to attract individuals who are interested. And in some cases, they may be interested for positive reasons or for honorable reasons, but in other cases, it may just be because it's in their best, you know, they feel like it's in their best interest for them personally. But you can still make a choice based upon that. You can say, is this a route that I should take? And you have options. But I always believe that ultimately, you know, that as creative beings, we have to be responsible for all we create. And that's why I always try to start off my projects by being as responsible as I possibly can be. And that includes, you know, publishing. That also includes, you know, copyright issues and so forth and so on. All these things, I really take those things seriously. And then always, you know, there's always opportunities that stem out of that, you know, by being responsible. And then you can ultimately decide whether or not you want to go a different route, if you want to go with the publishing company later on, or if you want to go with a radio show network, online radio show network later on. You can at least you have those options. But in the first place, I try to approach things as it relates to my own creativity, hands-on. You know, it's my creativity. I have to do it the way that I need to do it. And if opportunities come out of that to do other things, then that's fine.
Absolutely, absolutely. So where do you see this book taking you to your next journey? As I say, you'll always have a book within a book or something else. What do you see coming up the pike based upon your work on this book?
Yes, that's an excellent question. What I see, and I've already begun production on, is there's a story inside of the book called The Coming of Cato. And The Coming of Cato, it's an allegorical treatment of the power that we have as a human species to positively impact the nature of reality here on planet Earth. So inside of that story, it's really like a parable. The way that I approach that work, and a lot of the information that I share inside the book, I approach it that way. It's like a parable. I'm going to be turning that into a motion picture. So that's, you know, really, it's almost, on some level, I feel like, you know, writing the book was kind of just the beginning steps and the preparation so that I can actually turn a particular story that appears inside the book into a motion picture. So this, it's going to be a long-term project. I'm looking at the next 4 months of working on turning that story into a motion picture, and there's a whole lot of work that's going to be involved in it, but I'm very excited about that project.
Great. Now, when you say motion picture, are we talking good old-fashioned up on the big screen epic? Are we talking, you know, very intimate, say, indie type down to earth, or what are we looking at there?
Yes, it'd be indie. it'd be down to earth. You know, I could, you know, to be honest with you, because my wife and I, we're always looking for, like, good films. You know, we're always looking for good films, and it's very hard to find good films these days. And what you find, you know, on the big screen or what you see with the big Hollywood productions, a lot of that stuff, and excuse my language, but a lot of it is garbage. It really is. Like, there's no real substance. It doesn't impact people in a positive way. And in many cases, the imagery and the types of archetypes that are printed, presented to the population are so degraded. So that is not really an outlet that one can expect to present a piece that speaks about the spiritual power that the human species has to positively impact the nature of reality on planet Earth. You know, you know what I mean? So that's one of the beautiful things about the internet, is that now we have this outlet to where, if you do have a positive message, and it can come in the form of a radio show, a blog, a short film, or even a book. I mean, you can have your book on your internet, on your website as a PDF format or what have you. We have this outlet now where people can begin to share the information, whereas before it was like you had to kind of go someplace, somewhere, or you had to try to self-publish, and there was a lot of labor involved in terms of material work that needs to be done. But now, since a lot of things are electronic, there's not as much material work that needs to be done. You don't have to necessarily, you know, have your film inside of a theater and go through the process of getting your film inside of it. Now people just go online and they can watch it off of your website. You know, so it's a wonderful, in terms of technology, how it can be applied to assist and to kind of bridge these gaps. But I'm always clear. I don't, you know, my work is not the type of work, and it never really has been, that I would expect, you know, to appear you know, in a theater somewhere next to, you know, a blockbuster motion picture. That's not even, you know, it doesn't even seem right. You know, it's like two completely different worlds, you know, of creative expressions. And my wife and I, we're always looking for good movies, and we run through these movies, and some of them we watch like 5 minutes, and they have all these rave reviews. And after 5 minutes of watching the film, we look at each other like, wow. And then you look at the budget for these films, and it's like $10, $20, $30, $40, $150 million. And you're like, you know, all this money is being spent on these movies, and yet we couldn't find anything of value inside these movies. In fact, what we found in a lot of these movies, and that's part of the reason why we ended up turning them off, is that a lot of it is merely to manipulate people in negative ways and to impact people in a negative way. So within that type of an environment, you know, I just don't have the expectation of my work appearing on the motion picture stage show, if you will. I would much rather it be a more intimate. I can have it on my website, on my YouTube page, on my Facebook page, so forth and so on. So that would be the route that we'll be taking in terms of turning this short story, The Coming of Cato, into a motion picture.
Okay, okay. Well, now you never know. There are some really good indie circuits and, you know, art house theaters that do show some very good films, which, of course, as you say, get limited review if they get any reviews at all. And the things that come out of Hollywood, back in the day, it used to be the land of dreams, and their job was to make the bad go away and show you, you know, hope and positivity. And now their job is to manipulate and sell things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you're right, it is garbage. It's regurgitated garbage. Why lie? It's gotten to the point, I mean, it used to be if you went to a film, it was probably based on a play.
Mm.
Whether you were talking about Gentlemen Prefer Blondes or, oh, what's the one just popped in my head? I can see, was it Stella? Stella, what was
this? Oh, Rocky.
Marlon, the one with Marlon Brando.
Oh, I thought that wasn't Rocky.
No, that's a bunch of Stallone. He actually wrote that script, though. There is a difference. He actually did do that as an independent, the first Rocky. Boxcar Desire, something like that. Those kind of films were based on plays.
Mm-hmm.
So our media now is not so much based on books as it is based on regurgitating already bad films.
Mm-hmm.
And every now and then, you know, they'll throw a graphic comic in there and, you know, wonderful. I can see how nice the story, you know, the special effects are, but it doesn't really have anything to do with facilitating positivity. Unless, of course, you know, you happen to be a special effects engineer and you care that they've got this new great technique in, you know, making, you know, comics look real.
Mm.
But, it is hard to find good things. It's hard to find good archetypes out there.
Most definitely.
And we had touched upon this earlier this week as to the fact that because most people are, you know, taught based on what they see happening on TV or in the movies, that's how they judge other people.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And the problem with that is one, it's rarely ever correct. There's your main problem.
Yes.
Whether you're talking about how they archetype the typical American black male, or whether you're talking about how they archetype American black women, look at blondes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how many? I'm sure there's lots of blondes out there who, you know, ladies, you're sick and tired of people all thinking that you're stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Or that you're dumb, or that, you know, that's just not right.
Yes. My wife, she commented on that, too, because many people are impacted by that particular archetype. I mean, all the different archetypes, we're impacted by it, and we begin to engage in behavior patterns, thought patterns. Some even our language may even change, you know, on some levels. We may begin to take on the language of the particular archetypes that I begin to identify with. And my wife said, you know, even the dumb blonde, what they call the dumb blonde archetype, which they present in films over and over and over and over again. I mean, it's in Star Trek. You know, I've done work dealing with breaking down Star Trek and the subliminal messages and archetypes that are presented. So you find it there too. And this is supposed to be in the future, someplace where, you know, everyone is living happily, and, you know, men respect women, and, you know, women respect men, and it's just this utopian society and all this stuff. And yet, you still find these archetypes being presented. And my wife, she told me, she said, you know, there was a time where I subscribed to that archetype. It depended on the situation. You know, if I was in a situation where, you know, people expected of me to be like a dumb blonde, then I would embrace that role or embrace that archetype. Or if I needed to be the, you know, woman with the bad attitude, then there were times that I had to embrace that, you know, at times, depending on situations and circumstances. And that's all programming. And you know, obviously nowadays, like I'm 36, you know, my wife, she's 30, oh my goodness, I can't remember right now, 30, she's not going to hear this.
She's not listening.
Yeah, she's 32. I hope she's not listening. Okay, I think she's 32. We're older now. We have children, so you know we've progressed beyond particular programs, and we can look back and we can be self-critical of the programs that we've accepted. And when we look at those programs, we realize that you know the vast majority of them. Sometimes it comes from family members, it comes from the environment, it may come from magazines or you know, but the vast majority of it comes from television and movies. That's where the vast majority of it comes from. And now, of course, the internet as well. But the vast majority for a long time has been movies and television shows. And I know that I've abided to particular archetypes as well over the years that were not accurate representations of who and what I was at the time or the potential that I had of, you know, in terms of becoming something greater. And I mean, we talked about this too. You know, it's like if I don't listen to rap music, then somehow something's wrong with me, you know. If I don't, you know, if I don't call women out of their names, and somehow there's something wrong with me because that's not what's expected. Okay, I have five children and I'm an honorable man. I consider myself, and I know myself to be an honorable man because I handle my business, and I love my wife, I love my children, and I'm here on the planet to be in service to them. So if I'm not an absentee father, or if I'm not beating on my wife, and I'm black, then somehow there's something wrong with me. Well, this is all based upon these illusionary archetypes that are presented through media where people begin to categorize people and expect certain things from them based upon how they look. And we get it a lot inside of media. And that's why, in terms of my work, I've always tried to produce content that can begin to turn that tide. I remember we even spoke about, like, there's one of my earlier films where I speak about these particular spiritual concepts. There was an individual, and he was from another country, and he didn't know what I looked like when he first saw the film. And he was like, oh, this is awesome. He kept sending me all these positive emails, and, you know, he was giving me all of this wonderful feedback. And then when he finally saw a picture of me, he emailed me back and was like, well, look, I didn't know that you were black. You know, I thought that you were white. And now that I know that you're black, I'm going to have to take another look at your work, because I'm not quite sure whether or not it's, you know, something to the effect that I'm not sure that it's now legitimate or something like that. And I look back, I just thought about it, like, well, you know what, black males, we can't present something of value. We can't speak intelligently. We can't provide you with something that can benefit you. You know, is that the expectation? Well, for many people, the expectations are based upon the programming that they get in media. And that's definitely something that I consider to be very unfortunate.
It's true. And, you know, the sad part is they miss out on learning a lot about a culture. You have to step outside of that. And a lot of people don't. And when I was going through school, first thing my mentor told me in communications, you have to be careful of when you create your programs because you are God. And in being that God, this is how people are going to perceive everybody that shows up, whether you're writing your books, whether you're producing a film, whether you're producing a television show. How you depict people is going to be how those other people who watch this learn.
Mm.
And everybody in class thought it was funny that he said this because, you know, here's this little old white guy, probably I think he was in his late 50s. And I took it very seriously. And everybody's like, that's not true. And I'm like, really? When was the last time you ever met a black person from Nebraska? And then you have this dead silence. Well, what do you mean? What do you mean? What do I mean? It was a legitimate question.
Mm.
Well, there aren't any black people in Nebraska. And he just looked at him and was like, well, how would you know that? Well, we've never seen any in a movie. Really?
There you go.
There you go. I guess it just answered your question. And they're like, well, are there black people? Well, obviously, because that's where I was born. And then it was really over with. What? Yes. Just because you didn't see it in a film doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Right.
Just because
right.
you don't see it on the news doesn't mean it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
There are bad things that happen all the time in the world that just because it didn't make the news doesn't mean they are not happening. You know, I'm sorry, you know, it's not that time of the year that they need to be publicizing certain, you know, aspects. For instance, right across the street from my house, about 3 weeks ago, we discovered that there was the body of this poor little 13-year-old girl. this doesn't happen. This house, this has been a neighborhood that's been quiet like this for 28 years. And then all of a sudden, I've got this poor baby found dead literally less than 20 yards from my house. And because unless it was something really important, the only people who would have heard about it either A, lived in this in the neighborhood, went to the school that's here, or they are local in the region. Every, you know, maybe a few people in affiliates might have picked it up, but usually it's not how it works. But now people will sit there and they'll perceive, oh, well, you must live in a bad neighborhood. No, you know, annoying with the Little League every now and then, but no, it was just one of those sets of circumstances where this happened to this child. But it's a horrible thing because it didn't make mass it didn't make mass news because she was a victim of bullying, which also we talked about is another, or this is an offshoot of media manipulation.
Most definitely. My wife brought up bullying today, and she didn't even hear our interview.
That's funny because it was actually on a talk show earlier today. Somebody was being bullied. Yeah.
I'm sure it's part. I mean, it's like a media blitz. We have these media blitzes that come out, and it's a particular topic. And one of the topics that is presented and been kind of regurgitated over and over again is this idea about bullying. And it's interesting because, you know, bullying in and of itself has been going on for a long time. You know, I mean, every time a country goes and takes over another country, that's a form of bullying. Every time you drop a bomb on some innocent people somewhere, that's a form of bullying. You know, every time a man yells at his wife or you know, assaults her physically, that's a form of bullying. This is happening all the time. But one of the things that has happened in terms of children is that bullying has become like this media blitz. And part of the media blitz, it's not designed to empower people. You know, because the truth of the matter is bullying has been going on for a long time. It will continue to go on for a long time, you know, until such time, you know, people look internally, begin to refine their internal condition. And that's why focusing on the symptom of a problem is not going to actually provide a cure. But the point being that really what bullying is doing in terms of the mentality of young people is that it's setting up a particular dynamic. And the dynamic is wherein one either considers themselves to be a victim, or one considers themselves to be the bully. And for most people, most people's orientation, I think in general, the most many people's orientation is that of a victim. So children are being programmed to perceive their existence based upon a victim mentality. And bullying is just one, you know, offshoot. That's really symptomatic of other core issues. But that's a core issue that's a topic that has been used by media that has really caused young people and old people, you know, as well, to adopt the victim mentality without dealing with the real core issue, which is that the individual who is bullying, they have some internal issues that needs to be resolved. So you don't provide a real solution. What you do is you just propagandize that particular issue, and in propagandizing that particular issue, you set up an environment where individuals have to choose. Are you going to be, it's like survival of the fittest, you know, in the school system, and to a large degree, it's based upon that principle, you know, survival of the fittest physically, intellectually, in some cases sexually, you know, depending on, you know, the school situation and the environment that children find themselves in inside the school system. It's based upon this principle of survival of the fittest. So the bullying concept fits perfectly within that because you're either going to be the dominant individual or you're going to be the victim. You're going to be the victor or the victim. And for many people, they're being indoctrinated. For many children, they're being indoctrinated into this concept of victimization. And this concept of victimization is to be carried on into adulthood where one externalizes power and they continue to perceive that there is something external of them that has more power than them than they have to positively impact the quality of their life. And this is something that we are really propagandized into accepting this concept early on. The school system does this to a great degree, and it is expected for us to maintain that into adulthood.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the sad part is the media's role in this, as you say, is not to empower. It's to sell something. Right now, the big deal is to sell this media mass marketing thing on, oh, let's have this big anti-bullying campaign. Well, you can't have an anti-bullying campaign unless you plan to take off every television show produced, you know, that's on the air right now. Because what, you know, teasing somebody, making fun of them because you don't like their culture, you don't like their weight, you don't like the color of their eyes, their hair, that's all bullying. So every television show would have to come off. What are you going to be watching? Nothing.
That's so true. You know, because even the archetypes are a form of bullying. When you present a particular derogatory archetype to massive amounts of people, you're bullying people. You know, you're in a sense, you're bullying people to accept that archetype as being an accurate representation of reality itself. That's a form of bullying. So you're absolutely right. I mean, if the bullying campaign, I see the in terms of the behavior pattern of bullying, a lot of that behavior pattern stems from the media manipulation in the first place. So now, you know, media goes on a campaign to deal with the symptoms of a problem that was largely sourced from media programming in the first place, i.e. television shows, movies, et cetera, even music, you know, to a great degree. A lot of the music that was running around when I was growing up, a lot of that was based upon this concept of a victim and the victor, someone being the dominant, or, you know, the masculine projection of power, and everyone else is subservient to that. This is something that we found a great deal, especially in rap music during the time that I was growing up, and even more so within gangster rap, which was another depiction that was exploited by media so as to project a particular archetype. And that is a form of bullying, because now you're forcing other people to accept this archetype as being an accurate representation of their reality. Then they begin to take on the characteristics of that archetype, even if those characteristics are not reflective of how they were raised in their own environment and what their parents gave to them. This is also a form of bullying.
That's so true. And then it comes right back to another thing that we touched upon: people who identify with the archetype but can't stand the person or the ethnic culture that the archetype is wrapped around.
Most definitely. And we use the example of what people would call hip hop culture. I don't even consider it to be a culture, because culture embraces more than just music. It's amazing to me how a group of people can be reduced to a cultural identity that is centered around musical expression. And that's it.
Oh, come on. It's happened over language.
Yes, most definitely. And we talked about that too.
Absolutely.
We talked about that too. Yes. But in terms of the projection that has manifested out of these archetypes that are supposed to be representative of reality, for many individuals, they begin to identify with those archetypes. They begin to perceive those archetypes as being a representation of them. They begin to believe that whatever happens to that archetype is happening to them. They begin to think that whatever that archetype is saying, that's what they're saying. It's like this external projection of identity. There has to be a psychological disorder that is associated with this dynamic, because I've seen it time and time again. And so the problem becomes, that you stated earlier, if the archetype that is presented is not accurate in the first place, well, then now individuals are embracing an archetype that is not accurate, and then they begin to play the role in their own life of that archetype, whatever that archetype might be. And I'm of the opinion that in terms of, you know, my wife and I, how we raise our children, we don't have a television in the home. You know, we were very careful in terms of what we allow them to view, what we allow them to read. We take a very hands-on approach, because we want them to know their authentic self, meaning internally, not to have something external define who you are, not to have a musical style define who you are because you look a particular way, not to have a particular language type to define who you are, something external. No, that your internal being, your authentic self, is what you should be able to project, and you should be able to project that freely. See, it's interesting, because for some of us, when we begin to project our authentic self, and this means that the essence of what you are does not necessarily have to correlate to the next person or to the next group of people or to the next society. When you begin to project your authentic self, all of that which exists external of you is not as important as you staying true to the essence of who and what you are. And what happens for many of us is, as we grow up and we begin to reshape our identity and really reclaim our authentic self, we begin to break the programming that somehow you have to be a dumb blonde. Somehow, if you're a black woman, you have to have a bad attitude. Or somehow, if you're a black male, you have to listen to rap music and you have to be thuggish. Or whatever the case may be. If you're Asian, somehow you have to be docile, whatever the program is. If you're Mexican, somehow you have to, you know, like to eat burritos all the time, whatever the program is. When we begin to break those things, in many cases what happens is the people that we're around begin to somehow look upon you as if something is wrong with you. You don't fit the program that we've been running, and the program that we've gotten from media and the various archetypes, so now something's wrong with you. You're not black enough anymore. You know, you don't curse enough, so you're not black enough, right? You don't have a bad attitude, so you're not black enough, right? You don't listen to rap music, so you're not black enough, right? Whatever the case may be. And it's interesting, this social dynamic where as soon as you begin to embrace the authentic you, which is something that can only be defined by your internal workings, now something is wrong with you. But this projection that we get from society, that somehow, you know, there's something must be wrong with you when you begin to embrace and reclaim your authentic self. This projection has more to do with media programming and media manipulation than it has to do with your own personal reality. See, your own personal reality is what you make it based upon your authentic self. But the societal reality and what people, many people prescribe to and are indoctrinated into is largely based upon media manipulation and the projections of archetypes that media presents. And that somehow if you're black, you have to be a particular way. Somehow if you're quote-unquote white, you have to be a certain way. If you're Asian, you have to be a certain way. And I'm going to say this right now. The concept of race itself is a form of propagandization. The concept of race in terms of it representing some sort of genetic makeup, this is something that is a recent phenomenon that has occurred over 600 years, over the last 600 years, and was institutionalized in terms of in the realm of science so as to justify African enslavement. Prior to that, when people said race, it was not associated with genetics or hair texture or color of skin. Race meant a sporting event where people got together and ran a race. See, so even this is a form of media manipulation en masse, and out of this media manipulation, you have behavior patterns. And again, this is through manipulation. Behavior patterns, thought patterns centered around race, which are now people become racist. See, racism is real, but the concept of race is an illusion. So racism is based upon an illusion. And how do people accept illusions? They accept illusion based upon media manipulation. And that's why the media manipulation part must be understood.
That's so true, yes. Without environmental conditioning, where exactly are you? Well, you're left without a self, because, and that's the sad part. That's where all this bullying, especially in kids, are coming from, because they have no real self. Everything they are, and even with some of their parents, based upon what the media told them they had to be. For those of us who are actually, I remember the hip-hop phase and when gangster rap came out, but I actually was a child, a baby in the 70s, and I remember the archetype for women. Everybody wanted to be Ozzie and Harriet Nelson. You had to have the perfect nuclear family until, you know, the sad part was they ended up with a shotgun wedding because their son on the show had ended up impregnating the young lady who was on the show. That's where the whole, you know, and then that show had to be taken off the air. Whereas now, because that was not considered an appropriate behavior, you have just messed up the nuclear family. Men were supposed to, you know, you didn't go out and do that kind of thing. So every woman was always brought up to be like Harriet Nelson. You were docile. You had the food on the table. You had no real job, quote unquote. Your job was to sit there and clean up house every day and make sure your husband had to want for nothing. And you had those social groups that you did with the women, you know, and in court and getting your hair done. And then flash forward.
Wow.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah, I never saw that show. I was born in 1975, so I never saw that show. But I've heard about it. I got the reruns.
I actually got the reruns of that because I was born in 67. So we got the reruns. And then when you come forward, when Britney Spears' little sister, who had that real popular show on Disney, ended up getting pregnant as a teenager out of wedlock, they just decided, and Disney's really good for media manipulation, they just threw on a TV show called 16 and Pregnant, and whoop, whoop, whoop. And they've been working that ever since. You know?
And don't get me started on Disney. I did a documentary called Walt Disney, The Foundations of a Pedophilic Institution, because a lot of the content that they present on Disney is rooted in the sexualization of children, right? So I'm not surprised at all.
Oh, well, no. See, I always thought that was how American media was rooted anyway, since they push being young as some kind of archetype to being great. Now, I don't know how many people remember their high school years. You were not great in high school. And, you know, it's the truth. You were growing up, you were coming of age, but you had no clue as to what you were doing, and you were stumbling around pretending to be all that, and, you know, a bag of chips, but you weren't. And then you sit there and you see these really bad archetypes like, the American Pie films. They're still, you know, you've moved past all of this, and now we've got another one coming out where they got to go back because, ooh, we're growing up. and I miss what life was like in high school. Well, you hated being in high school. Let's go back to the beginning of your film series. You were perfectly great teenagers. You hated being a teenager. Then you wanted to be an adult. Now you don't like being an adult. But you still got this archetype that says everybody should act like Arrested Development and want to be back like you're in high school, only you want to do it as an adult. Well, no, that's not how it works.
Yeah.
Arrested Development is Arrested Development. It's a sign of immaturity. It means you have not developed.
No, most definitely. You know, most definitely. And a lot of the programming is designed to keep people in a state of arrested development. You know, if you can maintain a particular type of way of thinking and you can maintain it indefinitely, and when people are adults, they're still thinking on junior high school and high school levels. Well, in terms of controlling them and having them subservient to a particular system, it becomes very, very easy. You know, and a lot of the program is designed for that. And there's what I call reinstallation programming. That means that every, you know, usually 10 to 15 years, there are particular shows that are represented to the population as a form of to reinstall a particular program. You know, and they call them anniversaries, you know. So one of the things that, you know, what Disney does this as well, you know, and not only does it reinstall past programming, but it also functions as indoctrination for the next generation. You know, so it may be your children's children now are exposed to a Disney film that you saw. And in some cases, you know, their parents who passed down these Disney films because they feel like these Disney films were integral to their evolution into adulthood, even though they still may be thinking on junior high school and high school levels. And they feel like this is a gift that they can give to their children. But what they're doing is they're providing the same level of programming for their children that they received. Right. And it's not a conscious choice. It's an unconscious choice. A lot of manipulation is dealing with the subconscious mind. So this programming is now reissued. It reinforces the previous programming in the adult, but then it also functions as a form of indoctrination to this next generation. And this is how it perpetuates itself. And Disney has gone through great lengths in terms of this programming. They're very scientific in terms of when they re-release films, how they re-release films, and how they indoctrinate the next generation so that now you have cross-generational exposure to a particular institution whose content is largely founded on pedophilia. In my documentary, I go back to Walt Disney's initial films, and this was called the Alice series. And I break down and I provide evidence and proof, analysis of the video footage that I take a look at in terms of those early works. And I show how a great deal and a significant portion of that is designed to sexualize children. And that's why you have the sexualization of children, essentially, because even a lot of the individuals who have come out of Disney, Christina Aguilera, Britney Spears, as examples, in terms of the course of their life, you see this early sexualization and then this almost like this sexual expression that is based upon deviancy. Well, how is this possible if Disney is supposed to be this bastion of family values and it's all about wholesome, you know, being wholesome and you know, raising and being responsible? Well, how is it possible that the product that they bring, and not just in terms of projection and film, but also in terms of the individuals that they turn out, how is it that these individuals, in terms of the path that their life take, goes on such a chaotic course? Well, it's precisely because Disney has never been about family values. It's never been about uplifting high moral and ethical principles. What it was really designed to do, especially the early works of Walt Disney, was to promote pedophilia. And this is the foundation of the Walt Disney Institution. And that's no surprise now in terms of the content that Disney is currently producing, where you see these same themes being represented. And they've been represented for over 50 years now.
Very true. Very, very true. See, now, I was going to say, there's another part to the Disney empire that really used to irritate me, which comes to other aspects of, you know, like other people's work. When you have somebody who starts out with their vision and they move forward in a way that they try, you know, that they can at that point, like, for instance, Disney came up during an era where you didn't have racial mixing. It just was not acceptable. So his way around that was to create cartoon characters, and each one was assigned a race. And he did his own archetyping. Mm-hmm. And you know, let's laugh about who got Donald Duck, shall we? but he ended up archetyping that way. Well, the sad part about that is when the people who came after him that took over the running of Disney didn't have a clue really as to why he did it. But they took on the ugly side of it, and they keep facilitating that. In terms of, like, for me, I pretty much, Disney got washed away back when The Lion King came out, and even before then with Dumbo And I know I was definitely not born when Dumbo hit the air, but I definitely saw it growing up. And I remember the first thing out of my mouth was, okay, so the Indian elephant was having an affair with an African elephant, because the only thing I see different here is their ears. Mm. And everybody looked at me like, wait a minute. Wait, you're right. That's it. And I'm like, okay. But why is it every time he puts, there was a minority, especially if it had anything to do with black people, they were never humans. They immediately were made into animals and really horrible archetypes. We won't talk about crows and Br'er Rabbit.
Oh my goodness. Don't even get to the crows in Jungle Book.
Oh, I was about to bring up Jungle Book, because even Mowgli, he ended up still being a human. Now, don't let me lie. I love Baloo. I got my music on. But every one of the animals was a very famous black voiceover. They were all very famous black talents. They were all animals. Mm-hmm. And then we moved forward, and then they brought out the Lion King. Oh, no. Now, that one, bad. That one was just bad from the jump. We didn't even go any further than that. Everybody in it, with the exception, it didn't matter. It was because it took place in Africa. Everybody had to be an animal. How many, I mean, there are some actual, if you want to, pull in using some sort of historical, story based upon a culture, they actually have their own fairy tales. You could have brought in, heck, I would have put up with a Nuncie the Spider, as opposed to having you turn everybody into an animal just because they were in Africa.
Yes.
And then you turn right around, and I mean, even in modern millennia, so-called, we're in the future, you turn right around and did it with that, the one with the princess who got turned into the frog down in Louisiana. I can't even think of the name of that one.
Wasn't that the first, I guess, black or African-American Disney princess or something like that?
Yeah, and she was a human until, of course, naturally, she had to be an animal, too. They turned her into a frog by letting her kiss the prince, that old stereotype. She's supposed to kiss the prince, blah, blah, blah. Well, she kisses the prince, and she turns into a frog. So then you have to watch the rest of the film, and in which case the only humans that are left in the film is the villain. He luckily stays a human. Everybody else, they all got turned into animals.
Yeah.
I can't even think of the name of that when it comes on periodically now, but that was one of the only ones that they ever put directly into cable, as opposed to like their other, as you were talking about, they pull the other ones off, put them in moratorium, and move on.
That's right, and they re-released them. And I do analysis, too, of the Jungle Book. See, you're absolutely right in terms of the projection of particular archetypes as being animalistic and having an animalistic nature and animalistic features. And you'll find that in Disney, and you're absolutely right in terms of the racial dynamic. It's one thing, because during, the early works of Walt Disney, it was impossible to have quote unquote black or African American actors. I mean, it's like even nowadays it becomes even more it's still a difficulty. But then you can only imagine. Okay, it's just not something that is socially acceptable, and you may not. And this to say that it may be possible that Walt Disney wanted to that, or maybe he didn't want that, or who knows? But the point being is that in order to portray particular archetypes, animals were used as a means of doing so. You transform the human being, you make them an animal. And it's interesting because in terms of the Jungle Book, the animals that are considered to be black, in terms of the characterization of them, is also rooted in particular stereotypes. You have these horrible stereotypes, and then these stereotypes are really representative of particular groups of people that are defined based upon race. And it's a fascinating dynamic too, because the main character, the bear, his name is Louie. They hired an Italian American to play to do the voice of him. But this Italian American, he modeled his voice, he modeled his musical singing style, he modeled his trumpet playing after Louis Armstrong. You see. So this is strategic. We're not going to hire an African American to play these characters. Even though we're gonna transform this character into an animal, we're not gonna hire African American. We're gonna hire a different group of people or a person who can mimic the style and the vocal inflections and the characterizations of a quote unquote black person. So in terms, and then it's interesting because the individual that they chose, his name is Louis Prima, and Louis Prima. Mm-hmm. When people see the film, they're not gonna associate the ape with an Italian American. Okay, they're not going to associate with Louis Prima because Louis Prima wasn't a world figure. He's basically an unknown in terms of the scope of the realm of jazz and jazz history. But who is the world-renowned figure and probably the most preeminent jazz musician of all time? Louis Armstrong. So when people saw that, and I've had people email me, they said, you know, when I first saw Jungle Book, I thought that that was Louis Armstrong, if they hired him to do that particular voiceover. No, they hired an Italian-American who had mimicked his style. And inside the realm of jazz, we call that he cloned himself after Louis Armstrong, and therefore he played the role, and therefore they were able to project a particular characterization of this ape that is based upon the African-American experience.
See,
this is the depths of the manipulation. It's not just who they choose to play the role, it's what that person can, and what they can kind of bring into fruition, how they act, how they behave, the embracing of a particular cultural dynamic. And Louis Prima, he had embraced jazz to such a degree, and in the jazz realm, he is not considered to be a significant contributor to the realm of jazz. However, in terms of his adoption of the styles of Louis Armstrong, he was a perfect fit, because now you don't have to pay Louis Armstrong, who was an African-American. You pay an Italian-American to play this role that has a subliminal resonance and a subliminal association with Louis Armstrong. See, that this is a science, and the way that they do this is very strategic, and people really got to take a look at that, because I got people who email me and like, no, well, you know that the person who did that voiceover, he was an Italian. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is, how do people receive that? See, when they hear the bear or when they see those crows who are shucking and jiving in the Jungle Book, they're not asking, okay, is the person who's doing the voiceover, are they white? Are they Asian? They're not thinking about that. They automatically assume that the person is black because the person that voiceover itself sounds as if it's a black person who's you know, doing the voiceover. So this is another dynamic that needs to be understood in terms of the manipulation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, that's so true. And it happens. And even speaking of Italian Americans, look at the ugly dynamic that happened with that culture based on a book. Got to love Mario Puzo, you know, love the books, but that did not help Italian American culture.
Now, which movie are you talking about?
We're talking about the Godfather series.
Oh, I know. And you got oh, my goodness.
Yes. Now, don't let me lie. I'm happy that I get to see Al Pacino now, because had that series not been produced, we would have never seen Al Pacino or Robert De Niro. But unfortunately, we did not need that nasty stereotype for every Italian-American to either have to live up to or have to live down.
Yes.
And I'm sure they would have been happier not to, because now everybody associates that with, well, prior to that, whatever that new reality show was in Brooklyn and New Jersey, that focuses on the Italian culture.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That makes so much fun of them. But everybody's like, oh, yes, but it's such a popular thing. No, we're back to bullying again.
Mm-hmm.
You've now set up a dynamic where it's okay to think of these people as acting like this.
Mm.
All the time. Now, I'm sorry, I know many, many Italian Americans. No, they don't generally act like that.
This is no different than the projections for black people too.
You know, exactly.
You know, we got to be thugs. You know, we got to be belligerent. We got to curse a lot. And you know, when I was growing up, it's like, you know, people they look at you and it's like, okay, well, you're not black enough. When you see that same dynamic in terms of these particular shows for Italians, you're not Italian enough now. You know, somehow. And I'm sure, see, it's like, oh, what, there's not Italian American people out here who are not doing these things, who are, you know, I know the show you're talking about, I can't remember the title, but one of the people in there, their name is Snooki, right?
Yes, Snooki.
Yes. And these projections, I mean, that's no different than Sambo archetypes that African Americans were given, or rap artist archetypes that African Americans were given. Because the point, in truth, the rap archetype, the rapper, so forth, the so-called rapper, is really a modern-day characterization of the Sambo archetype. It's just set around 2000. Like, it's just the more futuristic treatment of a particular archetype. And the same thing for Italian Americans. That particular show, I can't remember what it's called. I think it's something Drive.
Jersey Shore? I think
Jersey Shore. Yeah, something like that. I'm sure there's Italian Americans who see these depictions and probably look at them and are like, what is this? You know, this is an accurate representation of my reality. And yet there are people who are watching that show, and then now they expect that behavior. They expect those characterizations from Italian Americans. And that's not fair at all. It's like you said, that's a form of bullying where you kind of bully people into accepting particular archetypes, even if those archetypes aren't reflective of the vast majority of a particular group of people. And I'll let y'all know, anyone who's listening to this, the vast majority of African American people were not thuggish. Okay, and we don't sit around all day listening to rap music, and we're not beating on our wives, and we're not abandoning our children. That's just the media projection of a group of people. That's not the reality for a great many of us, and this is something that we need to understand.
This is true, and I mean, if we're going to go that route, then there are just as many non-blacks who beat on their wives and listen to rap music, and you don't, you know, I guess it's not an in thing yet to publicize how much they do it.
Mm.
You know, because I'm sorry, there are just as many women who are battered and beaten who are white, Asian women, you know, Native American women, especially. That is a very big movement in the Native American thing, as well as in Latin American culture. But I'm sorry, they don't, you know, they're not going out of the way to facilitate that. But don't let me lie, they do go out of the way to facilitate other aspects of negativity upon
these
cultures.
That's right.
I have, my girlfriend is from Guatemala, and one man, she came unhinged. her sister had a baby, and so she was trying to do the paperwork to get her, you know, her mom and them to come up for the baby. And she calls me up, she was livid. What is the big deal about filling out paperwork, and what's the difference between a Hispanic and somebody that's Latin? And I'm like, okay. Hispanic is demnified in the United States as somebody being born in Mexico.
Mm.
Somebody who is Latin is anybody else from Latin culture, as long as you're not from Mexico.
Mm.
Well, even with, and then she started noticing it because she's very fair-skinned, the dark hair, beautiful. And her sister has a little bit more of the olive complexion. And even she started noticing the difference when people met her sister and then met her, and the difference in how they got treated, which really used to send her off. But it really bugged her about how the archetypes hit home. And she was like, why is it? And what's the big deal between filling out paperwork now? What does it matter if you're black of Hispanic origin versus, you know, non-black of Hispanic origin? I'm like, because one could be considered a slave, and you will get treated in slave mentality by the person who reads this, and the other one isn't.
Mm.
And she just looked at me, and I'm like, well, you asked for the answer. There it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As long as you cannot be perceived as slave mentality, meaning you're black and something else, then they can't project that upon you.
Mm.
They can try, but then you just look at them and go, no, I'm sorry. Well, it happens all the time. There are many Jamaicans who, they laugh about it. They're like, yes, we'll put up with Americans stereotypical because we make money off of it. But really, we don't all sit around with dreadlocks. We are not all unwashed. And no, we don't all play reggae music.
Or listen to Bob Marley all day.
Exactly.
That is so true. And see, a lot of this is based upon ignorance. You know, it really comes down to that. It's just they, you know, people's perceptions of other people, to a large degree, it's ignorant. And a lot of that, and see, the ignorance is what media plays upon. You know, media provides programming to the degree to which a particular group of people or a person or a society, to the degree to which they are ignorant in any given area. So there, this to say that if you are a racist, which is a form of ignorance, because you have to be ignorant to accept that, you know, this notion that somehow you're part of a race that's superior to some other race. I'm like, really, please. But if you accept that illusion, and there's a level of ignorance that's associated with that, but guess what? There will be program that is issued by media just for you.
Exactly. It's true.
Just for you.
It is so true.
Yes.
I can't tell you how many whites do I know from the South who can't stand Hollywood. They literally loathe Hollywood because of the stigma that they get stuck with. We're not all racist.
Mm.
We don't all have hanging trees, blah. I mean, they just come unhinged, especially a lot of the new youngsters. But and then what happens is the media, anybody gets into a fight with somebody, it could be over something, you know, typical, like, oh, you looked at my girl the wrong way. You know, guy stuff.
Mm.
Immediately, it's instantly a racial thing. No, that's two guys fighting over a girl thing. But if they're from the, you know, from they're from opposite, you know, ethnic groups, automatically it's a racial thing.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true. You know, that is so very true. I mean, see, it's interesting because even with the current Trayvon Martin media blitz, this same thing, this same principle is being used by media. You know, if this went down where it was two black males involved, it would not have become a global phenomenon. You see, it would not have, because these type of things are happening all the time.
This has been the first hour of my in-depth interview with author Lennon Honor. Please tune in next week for the conclusion of this in-depth interview. Thank you. Keep writing.
Thank you for joining us on this week's edition of Writers Radio with host Dr. Andy. Please join us again next time when Dr. Andy will bring you more success tips for people in the literary profession. Enjoy your writing.